the world entirely is at war.
Troops waiting for the zero hour.
This is D-Day.
They got one.
Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join host Gene Pell and an honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and fighting aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories from World War II,
a state of war,
to the present day.
Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait.
Now the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network present Veterans Chronicles with your host, Gene Pell.
Welcome to this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles. When Marine Corporal Jason Dunham's unit deployed to Iraq in 2004, he promised those under his command they would all return home, and return home alive. They did, because he sacrificed his own life by covering an insurgent grenade with his helmet and body to protect his comrades from a deadly explosion. His heroism was recognized on January 11, 2007, when President George W. Bush presented the Medal of Honor to Dunham's family. My guests this week are two Marines who knew Dunham well. Major Trent Gibson was commander of Dunham's company. Sergeant Jason Sanders served alongside Dunham. They share their memories of him and the incident that claimed his life. Major Gibson.
First of all, I'll explain that we deployed to Iraq with my rifle company, four rifle platoons, plus an attached combined NR armor team. I had 199 Marines once we got in zone. And I had reorganized the company in December of 03, a couple months after Corporal Dunham came to the unit, and just 2.5 months before he deployed. And the reason for reorganizing the company was to have a task organization that was better suited for unconventional warfare compared to the conventional task organization that you normally have in a rifle company, which is three rifle platoons and a weapons platoon.
Mm-hmm.
And being an 0331 machine gunner by trade, Corporal Dunham belonged in the machine gun section underneath Lieutenant Fleming, who was the weapons platoon commander at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So I reorganized the company into four rifle platoons, and I had a bunch of new Marines coming in from School of Infantry, which was going to increase our manpower by about a third overnight. And I made the decision then to spread load the new blood and took that opportunity then to spread load the weapons specialists as well and the leadership, the expertise in the company so that all four rifle platoons would be as equally capable as possible. So I dumped the company into a pile and told the platoon commanders and platoon sergeants to put together a draft pick of their top choices for leaders, starting with squad leaders, fire team leaders, and then weapons specialists. And then we got the company's leaders together and conducted a NFL-style draft in which first platoon commander got to pick in the first round one squad leader, and that went on down the line. Then Kilo 4, 4th Platoon, Staff Sergeant Ferguson, now Gunner Sergeant Ferguson, he put together his list for Kilo 4. And his first pick would be his first squad leader, Kilo 4-1, and that was Corporal Travis Struker from Iowa. And then because he was at the end of the first round, Staff Sergeant Ferguson got to take the first pick in the second round. And Corporal Dunham was his first pick in the second round. Despite the fact that he was not a rifle squad leader, everyone in the company had already got a good idea that Corporal Dunham was a very capable leader. He was a genuine, engaged, and concerned leader who commanded the respect of his seniors, subordinates, and peers alike just because he was a genuine individual and he didn't need to lead through intimidation. He just led by example. Corporal Dunham was on the other platoon's top picks for a squad leader, but Staff Sergeant Ferguson, Kilo 4, got to him first.
Uh-huh.
So that's how Corporal Dunham became a rifle squad leader from being a machine gunner.
Isn't that an unusual way to go about putting a squad together? I mean, it's sort of interesting concept, but
It was a little unusual, and it met with a lot of resistance from the enlisted Marines in the company, especially the experienced ones who had been through OIF-1, the ground war.
Right.
And they preferred to keep the guys that they had been through the ground war with together in the same squad.
Well, that's what I would have thought, that cohesion is one of those words that we hear all the time.
Right. And that was their main argument, was cohesion. And that was definitely a consideration for me, but it didn't override the need for us to spread load the new Marines, the company's leadership, and the company's weapons specialists. So that outweighed the cohesion factor for me.
Right.
And in the end, by the time we were done with that deployment, all the squad leaders agreed that we had done the right thing by reorganizing the company in that manner.
And battalion had no problem with that at the time?
Oh, no, sir. My battalion commander was supportive. He thought it was an interesting idea, and he was anxious to see how it shook out.
Right.
And it turned out very well.
Right. Well, you were on the other end of that, Sergeant Sanders. Were you one of those who didn't like the idea of the cohesion being broken up?
Definitely. It all took us by surprise at the beginning, but after we sat down and thought about it, you wouldn't want to stack just one platoon and have one platoon just stacked with the most knowledge and the best guys and all that. You wanted to, you'd want to spread load everybody around, expertise around, and we adapted to it pretty quick and enjoyed it. I mean, it was a good call by Major Gibson to do that.
Well, cohesion is one thing, but it's also the case that you guys are trained to do just about anything that is required of a Marine, so I suppose it's easier to pick up the slack than it would be for some other groups.
That's correct. It just worked out on every aspect of it, with the leadership, the knowledge of the weapon systems, the knowledge of the regular just rifle platoons. It worked out. It worked out real good.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about April 14th, 2004. Either one of you, and interrupt each other if you like.
Sergeant Sanders,
go ahead, Major Gibson.
By laying out what our mission was that day.
Okay.
And then I'll let Sergeant Sanders pick up, since he was obviously with Dunham when the incident occurred.
We started out
the day with a mission to head into zone, escort the battalion commander's patrol to the Crabble police station, and do a site survey of the police station and an adjacent water treatment facility, which the company would occupy as a patrol base for an upcoming patrolling operation that we were putting together. It would be a two-day-long operation in which we occupied that patrol base and then patrolled with the Crabble Police Department, who just gotten 36 new police recruits that had been trained up in our homemade police training academy that our attached MP platoon had put together for us down in the Alkheim train station. So we had a bunch of new police recruits that Colonel Lopez, our battalion commander, was pushing up to me for use in Carabla, and we figured the best way to get them trained up as quickly as possible would go into zone with the entire company and conduct a 48-hour-long patrolling operation with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, as you were, that 96-hour patrolling operation. It was a four-day event. And so we had to do a site survey first and talk to the police about what we were going to do and coordinate a few things. So I met Colonel Lopez's patrol in zone at the police station, and we talked to the police, set some things up, and then from there we went over behind the police station into the water treatment plant to determine its feasibility for occupation and defense during those 4 days. And I took Staff Sergeant Ferguson, the 4th Platoon Sergeant, the one who had picked Dunham, took him with me, because he would be in charge of perimeter security while the company occupied that patrol base. his platoon would be charged with security for those 4 days. And we'd been in the treatment plant for, I guess, about 10 minutes, and the battalion commander's patrol had departed the police station and pushed west upon Route Jade towards the Lima Company position up at the border checkpoint with Syria.
Mm-hmm.
And en route, his patrol was ambushed, and we're checking out the area inside the treatment plant when we heard some explosions to the west. And Lima Company had been getting mortared on a daily basis for about the previous 2 weeks. And catching the guys that were shooting at you was problematic. But it sounded like an opportunity for us to get the jump on some insurgents that were mortaring Lima Company. And that's what we thought the initial explosions were. And Corporal Dunham came up to me when he heard the explosions, and I said, "What do you think?" He goes, "I think Lima's getting hit." Sergeant Sanders then called up our vehicles, who had been patrolling around the police station and in the general area of the town of Carrabba. And Corporal Dunham got the patrol pushing west on the run to link up with the vehicles.
We're talking this week with two Marines who served with Medal of Honor recipient Jason Dunham in Operation Iraqi Freedom, Major Trent Gibson and Sergeant Jason Sanders. The conversation will continue after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles. Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veterans Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012. The American Veterans Center, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, in conversation this week with Marine Corps Major Trent Gibson and Sergeant Jason Sanders. They both served with Medal of Honor recipient Jason Dunham in Iraq, where Dunham sacrificed his own life to save those of fellow Marines. Now they describe the events of April 14th, 2004.
By the time we got in the vehicles, we figured out from the radio traffic that it wasn't Lima Company getting hit, but it was actually the battalion commander's patrol had been ambushed in an area that we called the HK Triangle. It was a little triangular-shaped village between Husaba to the west, up by the border, which was Lima Company's area of operation, and Carrabba in my zone. And we'd already had the majority of insurgent activity to date had occurred in the HK, and we'd been in zone for about 3 weeks at that point. So by the time we realized it was battalion commander's patrol that had been ambushed, we were at the HK triangle, and to confirm that it was actually an ambush, an RPG flew over the truck, one of the trucks in front of me that had our two fire teams in it. Our squads were organized into 2 4- or five-man fire teams, which is the organization that we had set up when we originally reorganized the company. So Corporal Dunham's squad, Kilo 4-2, he had two fire teams under him. The first fire team was led by Lance Corporal Bill Hampton, and the second fire team by Lance Corporal Joshua Carbajal. So when the RPG flew over the trucks, we realized we had arrived at the ambush site. So we unasked the trucks and got up against the wall for cover. And Corporal Dunham came over to me, and we decided to start pushing south through the HK in order to clear out the ambush. So we dispatched the vehicles down to the southern end of the HK in order to coordinate off and prevent the insurgents from escaping. And Corporal Dunham said he would take one fire team, which was Lance Corporal Hampton's fire team, and start pushing south on the eastern edge, and then I would go with Lance Corporal Carbajal, and we would start pushing south towards the western edge of the village. So two fire teams started pushing south a couple hundred meters apart from one another, and in the process there we ran across some vehicles that were attempting to get around the ambush site from the vicinity of Huseba to the west. And as it turns out, some of those vehicles had actually been in the HK Triangle during the ambush because they had insurgents in them. And from that point, I'll let Sergeant Sanders pick up.
Go ahead, sir.
Major Gibson set it up pretty good. We've been in this area before because we were out west for a while longer than the rest of the company. And we noticed a lot of vehicles that were in a place where a lot of vehicles usually aren't. And Corporal Dunham just right off the bat looked back at Staff Sergeant Ferg and was like, let's do it. Start doing a snap VCP on all these vehicles because we knew that something was fishy going on. And we were moving down there pretty good pace. And like the second and third vehicle down, that's when it all started happening. The guy jumped out, a couple more guys jumped out, and the wrestling started going down. And Hampton and Miller ran up to flank Corporal Dunham and the insurgent that were wrestling, and I was running right up behind them. And that's when the Corporal Dunham said, watch his hands, and that's when the grenade went off. And I thought I was looking at four dead guys right in front of me. And sorry about that. And that's when Hampton and Miller got up and started walking back towards me. And I just told him to get the hell out of there, get behind the wall. And then after they got by me, and they were all bloody and beat up pretty good. That's when the damn insurgent jumped up. He took one look at me and took off running. And I shot him a few times. And told Staff Sergeant Ferg, I was like, get me because I'm going down to get Dunham. And as soon as I started stepping off to go down and get Dunham, that's when I started getting shot at over the vehicle that these guys were in. Staff Sergeant Ferg started nailing those guys so I could get down there and get Dunham. I had to get behind the vehicle that the insurgents jumped out of for a little bit, tell Staff Sergeant Ferg and get them pinned down, quit firing at us. And then I started dragging Dunham back up. And then that's when basically everything left slow motion. And then I got back into working up the radio request for medevacs, started trying to get anybody there that I could to help us out, because we were three men down right there in a matter of seconds. So if something would have happened further on, we'd have been in a hurt locker quick. So I started getting all the communication spun up, all the info sent out, just to let everybody know what happened and to try to get them out of there.
We'll have more on the life and heroism of Medal of Honor recipient Jason Dunham after these messages.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network. World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiezhen area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
Heavy fighting is still raging.
3,639 wounded.
Red light, green light, and out, out. Get out.
Gentlemen, this is the real thing.
The brutal death march of Bataan.
Germany calling.
Germany calling.
Riding the purest pace.
We'll have the ammunition and we'll
cheer for Harlem on parade.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network. Once again, Gene Pell.
Welcome back to Veterans Chronicles. I'm Gene Pell, and my guests this week are Marine Corps Major Trent Gibson and Marine Sergeant Jason Sanders. Gibson was the commander of Kilo Company, 3rd Battalion, 7th Marines, in 2004. That was the outfit to which Corporal Jason Dunham belonged. Sanders served alongside Dunham and was present when Dunham threw his helmet and body on an insurgent grenade to protect fellow Marines from being killed or wounded in the ensuing explosion. Sanders was the first to reach Dunham's side as he lay alongside a road in western Iraq after the blast.
I knew that it was pretty bad because I tried talking to him, and I knew that he was still breathing, but I knew that he wasn't. It wasn't right. I knew he got shook up or got it pretty good. So I took him back, and we had a sniper with us, and he took care of Miller and Hampton while I was dragging Corporal Dunham up. And then there was this doc that come out of nowhere, Doc Chops we call him, I think because he had like some long sideburns. I forgot who he was with now, but he ran over to where we were from some other incident that happened deeper into the city, and he started administering first aid to Corporal Dunham while I was still getting all the information out for people to come help us.
Mm-hmm. So at the time, were you aware or not aware that he had put his own helmet over this thing and used his body to absorb the blast? And that he did it on purpose?
The way that he was laying, I knew that he put his body over it, but it wasn't until later. And it was me and Major Gibson standing there looking around, and we were like, what the hell is all this? And Major Gibson's like, that's the fiberglass out of the Kevlar. Yeah. And that's when I put it all together and knew exactly what he did then.
Well, Colonel Lopez reacted pretty quickly to this, as I recall reading about, as the action of an extremely brave and heroic man, and put him in for the Medal of Honor. Is that right, Major Gibson?
Yes, sir. What happened was, I think it was the next day, once we had recovered everyone from the operation, gotten back down to the battalion patrol base, I was talking to Sergeant Sanders in the Kilo 4 area, and he was talking about a conversation that Corporal Dunham had had with some other Marines in the platoon, Lieutenant Robinson and Staff Sergeant Ferguson, as well as then Corporal Sanders. And he explained to me that a conversation had come up in which they talked about actually trying to cover a grenade with your helmet to try and dampen the blast from it. And Dunham was convinced that you could do it fast enough to cover the grenade, and he even demonstrated to his platoon commander, Lieutenant Robinson, and Staff Sergeant Ferguson, that you could do it quick enough. Mm-hmm. So he had obviously thought about it and even rehearsed it, you know, getting his helmet off in about a second. And the platoon commander and platoon sergeant had warned him that, you know, it's not going to stop the blast. The best thing to do, try to cover it up with your sappy, which is the bulletproof armor plate that we have in our flak jackets now.
Mm-hmm.
So knowing that his helmet was in two large pieces and 1,000 smaller pieces, we filled up 2 1-gallon Ziploc bags with the scraps from his helmet.
Wow.
And knowing that his helmet had been subjected to a massive concussion, and then hearing this story from Sergeant Sanders, I realized that that's exactly what he had done.
Mm-hmm.
So I walked right over to the battalion command post and found Lieutenant Colonel Lopez and talked to him about it and told him, hey, look, sir, I think he covered that damn grenade with his helmet. And he said, yeah, sounds like it. And that's Medal of Honor material right there. So I went back to the company and had Lieutenant Robinson draft up a draft version of the citation.
Right.
And then myself and the company executive officer, Lieutenant Rudy Salcido, we all worked on it and then sent that final draft up to Lieutenant Colonel Lopez, who was waiting on it, and then they forwarded that on to division.
Though Corporal Dunham survived the initial explosion, he never regained consciousness. He was evacuated to Baghdad, then Germany, and finally to the National Naval Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, where he died 8 days after his heroic sacrifice. Jason Dunham would have been 25 years old on November 10th, 2006. By coincidence, that date also marked the 231st birthday of the United States Marine Corps. And it was the day in which the National Museum of the Marine Corps was opened in Quantico, Virginia. President George W. Bush announced on that occasion that Corporal Jason Dunham would be awarded the nation's highest recognition for valor, the Medal of Honor. Dunham would become only the second recipient of the award for service in Iraq and the first Marine since Vietnam to be so honored. I asked Major Trent Gibson what kind of reaction that produced in the Corps, where pride and recognition are tempered by the loss of a comrade and friend.
Well, sir, I think overall, at least to me and from what I've seen in all the Marines, it produces a sacred reverence for the sacrifice, the kind of personal sacrifice that incident and the award that finally recognized the value of that incident, that those things represent. And military service as a whole is based fundamentally on the notion of self-sacrifice for the greater good.
Right.
And Corporal Dunham, the man, exemplified that. So his actions that day were really just a confirmation of not only who he was as a person, as a Marine, but also of a long, proud tradition of self-sacrifice, service to others that Marines, soldiers, sailors, airmen have already established throughout our nation's history.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor bestowed by the United States government. Jason Dunham has also received other honors, one from his hometown in Seo, New York, which named the local post office after him, and by the U.S. Navy, which recently named a new guided missile destroyer after him. But to his fellow Marines, he will always be remembered in a different way.
He was a real human being. I know he's gonna be forever in our history, but he did take care of everybody that he was around. He loved what he was doing, never forgot what he was doing. And it takes a strong person, a very strong person, to talk about something, but then to go ahead and act in the manner that he did, and the place that he did, that I will never forget.
You know, I already explained to you how I feel about Corporal Dunham and his actions, but
right.
I mean, that's only part of the picture. And it pretty well closes the loop on who he was as a person, but I think it's important to explain just a little more about him. When he first came to the company in October of 2003, the company had just completed its post-deployment leave, after OAF-1. We returned in September of 03 from OAF-1, and Sergeant Sanders had been with the company the entire time. And I came there after the ground war and spent 3 months with the company in Carmela. And when I assumed command of Kilo Company, I explained to them that I believed in three things as a Marine: in leadership by example, in self-sacrifice for the greater good, and that one man can make a difference. And I stood there underneath the willow trees in a schoolyard in Karbala, Iraq, and explained that to Kilo Company the day I took command in June of 03. And then in October, when we got done with our post-deployment leave, we received several Marines, seven to be exact, from 3rd Battalion, 4th Marines, who were coming to us from a sister battalion, 3-4, because they didn't have enough time to deploy later with 3-4, so they sent them to us so they could deploy with us. And Corporal Dunham was one of those Marines. And you know, the day we formed the company back up after leave, we had those new Marines from 3-4, and so I took them to the side, and I knew I needed to tell them something, so I thought back to what I'd told Kilo, and I explained to them those three things that I believed in. And Corporal Dunham was there listening to me explain to him what I believed in, and therefore the things that I expect from them. And it wasn't until long after the incident, I was actually trying to put together a speech for the dedication of the post office in Scio, New York, that I attended. And I was trying to figure out what I was going to tell the people of Scio about Corporal Dunham. And I thought back to that day that we picked him up and the things I told him. And I realized at that moment that those things that I told him I believed in were the very things that describe Jason Dunham the best. And in that one act of selflessness, in covering that grenade with his own body to save the lives of his fellow Marines, he exemplified self-sacrifice for the greater good, leadership by example, and the fact that one man can make a difference. He made them a promise when he deployed with them that he was going to bring them all back alive. And in that moment of selflessness, he made that come true. He gave his life so that others may live. And every Marine from Kilo 4-2 came back alive. So he fulfilled his promise.
Our thanks to Major Trent Gibson and Sergeant Jason Sanders for sharing their memories of Medal of Honor recipient Marine Corporal Jason Dunham. For listeners who wish more information about Jason Dunham and his actions in Iraq, the story is told in the book The Gift of Valor by Michael Phillips, available in bookstores nationwide. Also, the Corporal Jason Dunham Memorial Scholarship Foundation has been created in his memory. Its mission is to provide college scholarships to Marines and corpsmen who wish to further their education. To learn more, visit their website, www.jasonmemorial.org. That's it for this week's edition of Veterans Chronicles, produced by Tim Holbert for the American Veterans Center and Kenny Burns for Radio America in association with Pelcom Communications. I'm Gene Pell. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, veterans, for your service to our country.
The great sea and air battle has been raging in the Solomon area since last Sunday.
From the Radio America Network.